Hey everyone, it's Travis, and I've got a really great show for you today. A mentor of mine from Google who talks to us about his life and about being brave and about, you know, avoiding that feeling of getting stuck in life. It's a really great episode. I know that you will love it. But before I play that for you now, I want to let you know about a live Trav and Los episode that we'll be recording next Monday, which is October 10th in San Francisco. So we're teaming up with AIGA, and they're hosting an episode, and we'll be recording in front of a live audience at a meetup. So if you are able, and if you are near San Francisco or the Bay Area, and you can make it, please come along and show some love. We're going to be talking to Jamie Leach, who is a really talented designer who I also work with here at Google. We'll be discussing the value of self-awareness and having an authentic voice in your craft. It's going to be a great night. Drinks, snacks, you know, the whole thing. Come meet me and Los and all of the friends of the podcast. Thank you to AIGA for putting it on. For information about where and when, visit AIGASF.org. And there's this big old event calendar on there on the homepage, and just click on our faces on October 10th and you can learn how you can join us for this live event. There'll also be a link in the description of the show, so don't miss out, and we'll see you there. Now, on with today's episode.
Late nights.
Late nights.
Late nights.
With Trav.
With Trav and Los.
With Trav and Los.
Late nights with Trav and Los.
I think we should, like, do something.
Yeah.
To start.
Yeah.
Because I'm feeling like my energy is, like, at, like, a 5. And it needs to be at a 10.
Yeah, it's a late night.
It's got to be a late night. Yeah. So what do you want to do? What do you want to do to start this thing out?
Slapping each other in the face always works.
Just for free? Or do you want to do Rochambeau?
Rochambeau. You
all
ready?
Right, all right.
Wait. If you're listening, we're playing Rochambeau to get some
they
energy.
They know the rules. We've done this enough.
One, two, three.
What is this?
That was big paper.
That's a handshake.
One, two, three.
Bam! I don't want to leave you out, but do you want to get slapped?
Sure, I'll get slapped.
All right, I'll do this. the first time we've ever done it with a guest. We asked Michael once, and he said no. Okay. Yeah. One, two, three.
Travis gets slapped.
That was a nice slap. Okay, so that slap that I just had right there was from Daniel Young.
Hey guys.
Daniel Young is my homie. He's my comrade in arms at Google.
That's what I hear.
I met Daniel around 8 months ago when I joined. He was one of the first people to kind of like greet me and kind of take me under his wing and show me around. So for that, I'll be eternally grateful because Google is a flipping confusing and complex place. Anyway, let's get started with this show. How do we usually do this thing?
Welcome to another late night.
That's how we do it.
With Trav and Los. And our guest today is Daniel.
Daniel Young. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to do two episodes. And the first one is going to be, we're talking about Daniel and more or less your biography. We want to learn from the lessons of your life. And then secondly, in the second episode, which is going to be published next week, we're going to talk about more specific things that Daniel's into, and I'm really excited about that stuff because I've talked to him about it already extensively.
Ooh, cool.
So, Daniel.
Hey, what's up?
Where do you come from? What's your Daniel deal?
Yeah, you know, I get that question a lot, which is, where are you from? And
genetically?
Yeah, no. The question I always post back is, well, how far back do I go?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
If it's like, yeah, I live in North San Jose now. You take a couple of years back and, you know, I was in Japan. I lived for, 6 months or so studying abroad in Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And then, California and New York, kind of just a bunch of places.
Yeah, all over.
Yeah.
Where were you born and raised?
So I was born in Bandung, Indonesia, and I grew up in the capital, Jakarta, for the first 10 years of my life.
For the first 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when did you move from Bandung, is it?
So Bandung was, I don't remember that early of a history, but mm-hmm. pretty much, I think, as soon as I was born.
Why to go to Jakarta?
Dad's work.
Mm-hmm. What did your dad do?
So my dad is, by day, he's a chemist and pharmacist. By night, he was like a pastor, musician. He does kind of a variety of different things. Mm-hmm. Still does it.
Still does it?
Yeah.
Is his ministry music-based like that, or does he just like do both equally and separately?
He does both, and he doesn't even do one church. He does like the regular ministry with kind of Indonesian congregations.
Mm-hmm. He's still in Indonesia?
No, he's here.
Okay.
He's pretty much kind of in LA.
With Indonesian communities in California?
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
But he also, he's also a music director for an American regular, you know, local church.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got it. And what about your mother? What's her life like?
She's for the longest time I've known her, she's a housewife, but she also does like accounting, bank teller work. That was after she moved to the United States. Uh-huh. When we were growing up in Indonesia, she also, we had a music school that was in front of our house, and she also like taught English. Mm-hmm. So just a variety of stuff.
You're saying we, do you have siblings then?
Yes. Good catch. Older brother.
Just one? Older brother?
Yes.
Okay. Uh-huh. Now, how many of the four of you are musical? You said your pop already.
Oh, geez. Yeah, we all grew up in a musical house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like one of my earliest memories was being chased around the house to try to like practice piano. And my dad would lock me in and I would sleep on the bench. Just like did not get along with it. It was okay, you know, you get by like playing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star and stuff. Uh-huh. Like that.
Yeah.
Ironically though, after I went to college, I kind of fell in love with music again. I was majoring in it for a while, even though I didn't end up finishing it. Yeah, but I played in a jazz band.
You played Twinkle Twinkle Little Star in college. just to get by.
Yes.
Just to get
by. On the saxophone.
Tell me about the story of like being locked in a room with a piano and sleeping on the bench. Is that like a normal thing in your culture? Is that, or is this like a unique thing to your father?
I think that's a normal thing for kids and parents. Because I've got moments where I want to lock my kids sometimes up.
Yes.
You know, you have that too, I'm sure.
Yeah. like substitute a piano for something else, I've done it.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Indeed.
So, okay. So, older brother, and where is he at now?
So, he's in England now. He is an orthopedic surgeon for the U.S. Air Force out of a base there. He's also got two kids.
Was he trained... Was he trained as a surgeon through the military?
He was.
Okay.
Well, yes and no. He, you know, went to medical school and the army paid for him. Mm-hmm. And in return, for like every year that paid for tuition, he gets to do one service with them. But he's just kind of stuck around.
Yeah.
He's like...
Can I hear the ambulances in the background?
Oh, I love it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Of course.
It's part of the ambiance.
Ambiance.
That is not added post-production. That is Redwood City.
Yeah, some poor soul is either getting arrested or picked up in an ambulance.
Mm, lively.
So question, I'm looking at the profiles that I'm constructing in my mind of your family, and I'm seeing someone who's good with numbers, I'm seeing a mathematician, I'm seeing a musician, and he's also a chemist, so we've got like a lot of like like rational kind
trying
of thinking.
Trying to pick out my DNA.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to dissect you and figure out who you are. We also have an orthopedic surgeon.
Yes.
Who was military trained, so like, yes, a lot of discipline right there. And then there's Daniel.
I've none of that stuff.
Who just to be like, just to paint the picture for our audience who Daniel is, like, I work with him at Google on the search product.
Mm-hmm.
And he's pretty well respected on the design floor. Mm. And he does a lot of work that influences everybody else's work. I would say it's like very broad work, and it's like influential.
Mm.
And I'm looking at the accomplishments and like the directions of your family, and I'm like where did design peek in for you? Where did you first get that idea?
This is a longer story. So what happened was, number of years ago, I was working. So before I became a designer, I was a network engineer, and that was my previous career. And I did that for a number of years. I was based out of Tokyo at the time. And I discovered swing dancing, totally fell in love with it, began teaching it. I was trying to market it. I was even trying to figure out a plan to like retire early so I can like teach full time.
Nice. Swing dancing.
So what happened was the natural thing, of course, what you do is you move to New York and you try to find a guy who would teach you how to sell in real estate. So I became a real estate salesperson, or at least I thought I did. I got my license.
Really?
Yeah, but this guy who I ended up, he was my mentor for a period in my life. He tuned my, I think like visual acuity sense into design. You know, he always talked about like the back of like a MacBook Pro monitor and like how the back of something could be so beautiful, and it was like
given consideration. He was mentoring you in real estate?
He was mentoring me at first. On like sales and like kind of the mindset of a successful person.
Okay.
I was trying to do all of that in order to like make my first million, retire, teach swinging dancing full time. That was kind of like the goal I had in mind. Anyways, he was the one who also ended up introducing me to like quite a different spiritual path.
Okay.
That was like, you know, he was a guy who lived in a very tiny closet, had like four pieces of suits, which he wore everything, and virtually like no other possession. He would wake up at 4 a.m. in the morning, meditate for 4 hours before he comes to work.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would be teaching me stuff like, you know, instead of thinking of like principles, like at some point you will graduate into moment-centered like wisdom, and just stuff that I had no clue what all of that was about until now.
How did that instruction come across to you? Was it very intentional, or was it most like by example, or how did he teach this stuff?
So I'll give you one story. It was I think I came in for an interview, and I forgot what was the context of the conversation, but he talked about like the idea of like presence and paying attention to things.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we talked about business, and I woke up and he pointed out to me that what I did was I left the chair in kind of an not so great state. I kept it out instead of like pushing it back in and keeping it neat.
After
I stood up from the table, and uh-huh.
He
called it out that
this
I was
during an interview with his company.
No, I think it was like after I was hired.
Okay.
So after we established some sort of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just like little things like that, he would point things out, and then, you know, I had no clue at the time.
But still, yeah. That's impactful. Like if you think about, or at least if I think about my working environment, no one's calling me out for leaving the chair untidy.
Right.
That's a different mindset.
It's totally a different mindset, a different level even.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that you're receptive to it.
Yeah.
Like having no background in mindfulness previous to this.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody's like, hey, you left a chair. like my like base reaction would be like, so? like we'll change it if you don't like it, you know? So one of the things that I know about you, Daniel, and I mentioned a little bit before about how your work is very broad in our organization at Google, mm-hmm. is that you see very well things in terms of structure and organization, and like systems and like in the way things are formed.
Mm.
And I'm curious about like how did that show up early on? Like, was this a childhood thing that you understood systems and
Talking about systems thinking in particular?
That is one of your strengths, and I want to kind of figure out where that came from.
So I think part of like the idea of seeing patterns mm-hmm. was something that I've always had. Like as a network engineer, you're looking at like topologies. You're talking about like large networks. You know, one of the things I did was I supported the whole entire like backbone for ADSL, for Yahoo Broadband, for all of Japan, for example. So you kind of like see this big picture thing going on. But I think what I've always had was growing up having to like move from place to place. I think it was probably, looking back upon it, it was like a defense mechanism to try to not to get too close to people. So I always had this like one step of like being a part of, like, because I didn't know I was going to move, you know, or like not be close friends with somebody.
You move around a lot. It was common for you to have to break relationships.
Exactly. So
how does pattern? I'm struggling to see the connection.
Yeah, I know. We'll get there. Okay. So what I would do is I would like.
We're on a journey right now.
I know we're on a journey. We'll see the pattern. It'll emerge.
Come on, but guys. I think I'll push my chair in. I promise.
It was about like studying people, like trying to understand what are the things. Why do people do the things that they do? Uh-huh. So when I was in college, you know, because my brother went into medicine, I thought I'd try it. I did it for a quarter, decided I didn't like it. And I began studying things like sociology, psychology, philosophy, and economics, right? All these things that center around human behavior. And none of this like made sense to me at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now that I'm in UX, I'm like, of course, technology, human behavior, like all the pieces come together.
Yeah.
But, you know, like they say, like life can only be lived towards and understood backwards. So the part that I do understand are the things that like I can see backwards.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you're looking for patterns with relationships. How does that protect you? I guess what you mentioned that, right? Am I wrong? Did I misunderstand?
The protection is this. If you understand why people do the things that they do, the things that you perceive as being hurtful or puzzling makes more sense. There's like a padding. It isn't so impactful when you're experiencing it.
So you can be more objective and say, this is what humans are like, instead of being like, why did this person do that to me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. You see yourself less as a victim and more as... it was an event with which you were a part of.
Interesting. It's very interesting.
What I like to know is, you started talking about how your mentor started giving you a sense of the design aesthetic.
Mm.
We never finished that thought.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
I think it was about like seeing the invisible, like the craft. And then also like having lived in Japan, like you'd see things like this, right?
Was in Japan?
This was not in Japan. This was in New York.
New York.
And this guy
was like living like a monk.
Kind of.
He had like four suits and he lived in a closet.
Yeah, but he was like a real estate salesperson.
Just simple, like minimalism.
I would think real estate in New York, you'd be doing well, like in terms of like wealth, right?
He had money, although I don't think he felt like he had the need for it.
Yeah. You know? Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to find, like, for this guy, like, what's the connection? Like, he's striving for a simple, minimalistic life, but at the same time, he's doing a job that's kind of, like, based in making money.
Yeah. You know, I think life is a paradox, and he's unfortunately not a guest here, so I can't speak for him.
Yeah, sure.
But if you look at, like, Steve Jobs, for example, mm-hmm. like, he was like that too, right?
Yeah, he had a little house.
Yeah.
A little cottage kind of house.
He didn't even have furniture for a long time, and then he got one couch.
So
it was a nice couch though, dude.
What I can speculate is this, like when you get in touch with something very deep and something spiritual, like you also become like a conduit with which that spirituality wants to manifest in the real world. And oftentimes like that can take shape in something that appears to be materialistic, right? In the case of Steve Jobs, it was like Apple was like his creation.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what mine is per se. And, you know, like, I'm still all trying to figure this out. Mm-hmm. But I'd say this is why, like, sometimes you see a paradox.
Right. That's interesting. So talk again about learning design early on from this person.
Mm.
And I want to hear about how you experimented with it.
How I experimented with it?
Well, trying to, like...
Oh, yeah. So I think, like, by that time, like, there was already an appetite for it.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the other source... was from looking at a bunch of very difficult to use interfaces when I was an engineer. Meaning like I saw a bunch of really bad design. And so it was like a combination of things. And so the way I experimented was, so after New York, I came back to Japan. I started a swing dance school. I became my own like teacher/promoter/designer. I designed everything from like websites to logos to banners, you know, like necessity is the mother of invention kind of thing. So I read a bunch of books. I learned like CSS. I learned like I was all like shooting from the hip. Like the thing that bothered me and what eventually got me back to art school was like I could figure out the how to make things. That was like lynda.com.
Yep.
Okay.
Figure out Photoshop, right? But the why? Why would you pick this typeface over something else, mm-hmm, for example? Mm-hmm. Why would you pick this color scheme? Mm-hmm. I had no vocabulary with which to describe my rationality. I didn't even have a process, right? You just kind of go with your gut. Mm-hmm. And I knew inherently there was like something more than that. That was it. I don't know that there's like an experiment other than like I tried it. It looked kind of good to me. And then...
that's so funny that... A lot of the people that we've talked, a lot of designers that we've spoken to, entered the design industry designing album covers, their band posters, friends' band posters, t-shirts, promoting your own swing dancing school, you know, and it's all around music.
I want to find the musician who started a designer and designed an album cover and needed some songs to fill it up with.
So they made
an album. That's what I want to meet.
So that's cool. It's a pattern that I'm seeing. And the pattern is not so much attached to music. It's around the necessity is the mother of all invention, right? And so like you happen to get good at something. You had a keen eye for it, being in Tokyo and New York and seeing it all around you. It's pretty cool to see that.
I want to hear, Daniel, about your failures. I want to hear about those early failures and frustrations and lessons.
What would you like to know?
Well,
there's a bunch of them.
Yeah, so let's just start. let's grab one, and let's dissect it.
Failures. Wow. I would say like choosing paths, for example, probably the earliest I can remember is like picking the wrong major, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I must have changed my major so many times. Like, first it was biomedical sciences, and then I pivoted into I thought I was going to go to law school, so I decided to major. The beautiful thing about law school is that you can major in anything and still, like, as long as you kind of like have a certain number of courses, like, you can do it. So I went to like I doubled in psychology and music, and then I'm like, I'm doing all these courses, so I might as well like pick something else. And end up at one point I had like four majors declared. I ended up graduating with like double the required unit. So I essentially like did two words of like a bachelor's education my first time. So that was a failure. Like, it was in a sense like you don't need to do all that. And of course after that I went to IT, which is completely different too.
Mm-hmm,
So that's one type of failure.
So can we say it's opportunity cost, this failure? You spent a lot of time going in directions that didn't ultimately pan out?
Here's the thing, though. You can always see something as failure, but if you look deeper enough, there was something to be gained out of it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Maybe this is where you were heading with that conversation.
Yeah, when we say let's unpack these failures and talk about... Because, you know, like a lot of people that listen to this, I mean, I was about to say a lot of people that listen to this are humans too. A lot of them.
Yeah.
Most of them are bots
or dogs.
I mean, you know, and our lives are full of this pattern, right? Of
humans.
Like lessons and failures and kind of like trying to figure out what to do next.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of looking at that here, and I'm noticing that your path is a winding road.
Oh yeah,
you've done a lot of different things to get to where you are, and I just want to like figure out how we can use these insights to help our listeners to kind of like identify with what you're doing and also get some inspiration.
Yeah, because I'd say some may already be on a winding road.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we get emails from people who are in their 40s, they're looking to new careers. You know, like it's not very uncommon that people hear this kind of thing that are looking for strength during a time of change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe we could get to this organically, but I might as well put it out there. I think, like, if I can look back upon my younger self and at every single moment in time when I was, like, experiencing frustration, you know, confusion, I would probably say, like number one, do whatever you can to not get stuck. Mm-hmm. And I define stuck by, like, repeatedly experiencing what you know is like the same thing over and over again,
mm-hmm.
right? You're asking the same questions again. You're like, should I do this? Should I not do that? And this goes on like, you know, like time and time again in your mind. Whatever you can do to not repeat it is a step forward, and you need to see that, right?
It's about movement instead of like success, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Because success, you'll get to by simply like not staying still.
Mm-hmm. That really hits a point with me because I read this Dr. Seuss book to my children called "Oh, the Places You'll Go."
Oh, yes.
You probably read it when you graduated high school or something. But, but there's this part in it where it talks about how, you know, you're going and you're running the race and you're doing great, you have a great pace and blah blah blah, and then you get stuck. And unstucking yourself is not easily done.
It's not.
Yeah. And it talks about the waiting place, where the waiting people are waiting for the sun to come up or the train to come or to win the lottery. You know, like people are just waiting for their big break.
Yeah.
And I had a guest at my house recently, and she's young, and she's around 19. And I said, so you're on this trip. She's touring California, and I was like, what do you looking for? Why are you here? And she says, well, my mom says that I'm gonna have a breakthrough. And I was like, well, what's your breakthrough? And she's like, I don't know yet. And I was like, have you broken anything yet? And she's like, no. It's like, you need to go break something.
Yeah.
And then you'll have a breakthrough, you know, like, and it's because it's about movement. If you're waiting, for the breakthrough, it's not gonna come.
Yeah.
And this is all from Dr. Seuss.
Dr. Seuss was a very wise man.
And then I dropped the book and left the room. Anyway, Daniel, I interrupted you with my
Not at all. That was a great point to make. It actually got me thinking about maybe, I guess, like the second point I would share. And so what a lot of people don't know is that they see kind of like this success story of like, oh, like Daniel just, you know, went to school, he graduated, got hired by Google, like immediately. Yeah. Like once, like, I think there's like a tipping point that happened. Once it tipped, like things appear to be like magical.
Yes.
But what most people don't know is like I've tried to change my career, I think like 3 times and failed. You know, like once trying to do the dancing thing, I was trying to do the real estate thing.
What happened to the dancing school?
The dancing school. Oh, this is another failure. So what?
Ooh, another.
What ended up happening was I handed off to somebody who, you know, one of my previous students who wanted to kind of keep the momentum going. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I did a very good job handing it off. You know, at the time I was kind of like trying to just not really be responsible. So I think it ended up like causing tension in our like friendship and stuff like that. Overall it worked out okay, but definitely like could have been done much
smoother. Why did you move on?
I moved on because I decided that rather than teaching dancing, I wanted to become a better dancer. So okay. I decided like my wife and I would go to the States where like more of the advanced dancers were here. I decided I also would take a 6-month sabbatical to cross-check one of those like things to do before you die list, which is like study Chinese, go to Taiwan. So that's when I took like a time off to do it. Yeah, those two reasons. I had like this nudging feeling like you just need to do something different. It was that call to like not get stuck.
Mm-hmm. Right. You were feeling stuck after.
I was feeling stuck, you know. So
that's interesting because you spoke earlier about your aspiration of like, I'm going to make my first million. I'm going to open a design school.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going to do for the rest
of
my life.
Oh, that changed too.
Oh, the million?
About the million thing. It's kind of silly, right? Like you decide to like, oh, I'm finally going to pursue my dreams after I make my million. And you're like, what did you want your million for?
Yeah,
so you could pursue your dreams. Well, why not just draw like a straight path from A to B?
Why do you need a million to start?
Yeah,
that?
Yeah. So that, you know, that took time for like that realization to come. And once you do, you're like, oh, of course, you know, slap yourself in the forehead.
It's because like, I mean, we're taught what success is, right?
Yeah.
We're taught that like
success is monetary.
Yeah.
Is what we're taught.
It's make your million and then do what you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
My wife's grandparents kind of they I want to say they suffer from this. So they waited. They tell us all the time we wanted to travel, we wanted to do
of
this
course.
And that.
Mm-hmm.
They waited till they retired and now they're like their bodies are all broken and they're, you know, they can't do it.
Yeah, I've been on this recent mind shift where instead of at the end of the road, looking back and say, this is a life that happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
choose the life that you want for yourself.
Yeah.
And so when I look back, I want to be able to say, I chose this life, and that's why I'm here.
Right? Yeah.
I did, I'm doing this whole thing. Part of it is like this workbook where I'm going through and I'm making a personal creed.
Mm-hmm.
One of the questions, one of the prompts was, imagine you're at your deathbed and you're surrounded by the people that you love. What are your regrets?
Mm.
And you have to kind of like verbalize them.
Yeah.
And, you know, point your finger at them and say, this would be a regret if it never eventuates or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that's a powerful tool to help you to like not need that million to go live your dream, you know,
I like that. And it's powerful because a lot of elderly people, grandparents, great aunts, great uncles, when you spend time with them, at least in my family, they'll tell me, you know, make sure you do, you know, this, or spend more time with your children. You know, kiss your wife one more time before you leave, and like all these things, right? Because because when they're looking back, right, they're looking at the moments that they're regretting.
Those are the regretful moments. Mm-hmm. They argued too much with their spouse, or they didn't play with the kids and they're tired.
But I've never heard you should go make $1 million.
That's a good point. Well, people don't care about $1 million.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's talk about how did you transition into design and how did you make your way to Google?
So that was pretty much a little bit more straightforward. I think after my third attempt, which was I was back in LA at the time, and then I was browsing through some design magazines in a bookstore, and saw this course at Art Center College of Design. It was like a course in typography.
Uh-huh.
I decided to figure out how to like go to the day program, and the teacher was like, well, if you get like a B+ or better, you could probably like do the day program.
And where did this idea that you can start over again and again and again come from, and the avoidance of getting stuck, like that's brave in my opinion. Where did that come from?
I like that you're asking these questions, Travis. I think I think the regret piece is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you realize that it's a much more greater loss if you decide to have regret than to like never try anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I know that specific line, that specific thought came from the 4-hour work week.
Okay.
Tim Ferriss. A lot of you guys like know about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think like the other thing is you also, and this is like a second point that I wanted to bring a while ago, which is like to take smart little bets. So here's the mindset that I think might help out. When I decided to let go of my previous career, which I was doing really well, you know, I was like making over, you know, 6 figures already. I was like very comfortable working.
Is this at the dance school?
No, as an engineer. My dad was concerned, like, are you going to be able to, like, you know, make the same income? Are you going to be okay? And the mindset that I had was, like, it didn't matter whether or not I would find success. What mattered was, like, if I did art school and all I did was just have that experience in and of itself and it didn't lead to any kind of career and I would go back like being an engineer, I would be completely okay with it. I think that was like the mindset that I had that like gave me maybe what you would call bravery. For me, right. It was like, of course, that you should just do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you make plans. You figure out, you're like, okay, I've got this much money. Here's what I need. You know, like once you find a strong enough why, the how like takes care of itself on its own, right?
Mm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So transitioning from this initial typography course into like a full design
went back, got my BFA
and then from there straight into Google.
Yeah.
Now you first were in the design or the creative lab in New York, is that right?
Correct. That was the first team at Google that I joined. It was in New York.
Tell everyone what the creative lab is.
So the creative lab is like half cutting edge digital marketing and half like product vision. I don't think they'd use those words to describe it, but that was kind of my experience.
Yeah.
So I joined the team that worked predominantly on product vision, and ironically, like we ended up working a lot on products that like had to do with search.
Yeah.
And so one thing led to another. At the end of like that program, they had this thing called like the five, which is they try to grab like the top five people they could find who graduated that year.
Okay.
And did this, what they call an externship program. They paid you, they fed you. But it was with the understanding that within a year, you'd probably move on to something else. Most likely other parts of Google. Some people, okay, like half of them like move on elsewhere. And then there's a small number who like stay at the Creative Lab.
Mm-hmm.
It was, so one interesting thing about the Creative Lab is that they try to like operate under the radar by like not spending too much money, but like doing things that move the needle, because they see that Google, because of its size and scale, tend to behave in a particular way, tend to see vision in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
And what they try to do is, so their mission is like remind the world what they love most about Google.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking of like, what is the product experience that gets people to like say, oh my goodness, this is amazing.
Right, yeah.
And their strategy is to like show it to the most influential people, like in a form of a story, and like get them talking.
Yes.
Like whether that results in something or not is like a separate thing.
Focus on the delightful experiences and show it to the right people.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
They're like an autonomous group. That's right? Cool. They don't really have responsibility for any one product or
they
outcome.
Don't make products. They're they operate under marketing.
Okay.
So technically they are about like ideas. They're about like creating the perception of that, like what do you love most about Google?
Right. So I'm currently working on a product that Creative Lab had originally done the vision for, the vision work for.
Oh yes, I am familiar with that.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really cool to like to see what their vision was, and then the project lands in my lap, and my job is now to make it real.
Yes.
To make it practically work, you know, and
yeah,
kind of like talk with the engineers and talk with the needs of the actual product owners and kind of figure those things out.
Pretty hard job.
Yeah. But it's interesting too, because Creative Lab is still involved, and I'm still interfacing with them,
cool.
And they come back with, they're like, Chavez, we like what you did. What do you think about this? And I'm like, that's amazing, but it's not
possible.
Like, I can't do it yet.
Yeah.
You know, like, and so it's really interesting to work with them.
Yeah, yeah.
So how long were you at Creative Lab?
I was there for a year. Like
for
the program
year.
Was a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you can talk about that you're really proud of there?
So I worked on part of what became the new Google logo.
All right. Great.
Yeah. And I worked on, let's see, what else could I talk about? No, can't talk about that.
check. No.
Can't talk about
that. Well, he thinks. I want to point to everybody who's listening to, Los and I have a reaction episode to the new Google logo when it was like first released
first
week, right?
Yeah, I remember.
This was before I joined Google.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we just like reacted to the logo for like 10 minutes.
Let me give you a snippet.
It's a good episode.
Yeah, it's a good episode. The snippet here and the sentiment was that the greater design industry was harping on a bunch of things.
Yeah.
And what we focused on was, we really don't care what it looked like. What we cared is that it happened.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
At a company of, you know, 60,000 people.
And it happened efficiently.
Efficiently. That was what was of note. I mean, I happened to love everything that came out of it.
It's good. We're very happy with it.
Yeah.
So I listened to that episode.
Cool.
And, you know, like at the time I heard about like this guy, Travis, who was about to join my team. Wanted to hear what like this guy had to say about it.
Oh.
It was because like, you know, I worked on the product. I was curious to hear what you guys thought.
That's
good. I was pleased to hear that there was like a very balanced perspective,
mm-hmm,
and like a way of looking at design, not just as form, but like as thinking. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, so that commentary that you guys had was like, you know, I thought it was like spot on.
Cool. We appreciate that compliment.
Yeah, that's nice to hear.
So after a year, you moved over to Search directly?
Yes, I did.
And how long have you been there now?
I've been there for a little over 2 years now.
Okay. And what do you like about working on Search?
Ooh, Search. You know, Search
next
is like...
Next I'm going to ask you, what don't you like?
Search is amazing, right? It's like one of the most like historical products. It gets, you know, like 8 billion uses a day.
Right.
It's like this thing that we all can't live without. It's what gave birth to Google.
Been 18 years strong.
Yeah.
We're legal now.
You're legal now.
Yeah. Even from the perspective of Google, it's like what feeds the rest of innovation that happens at Google, mm-hmm, because of that one core success that Google had.
Yeah.
So like working at Search, there's a number of like interesting things from the perspective of just like thinking about systems thinking and like unraveling its complexities, its relationships, to understanding like its impact to like, these aren't just like, this isn't just a product that, you know, a bunch of people use. It's also impacting the ability of the company to sustain its like long-term strategy for continuing innovation, right? Mm-hmm. And so you feel like this tremendous amount of responsibility to like do an awesome job. And you know, what I love about it is there's interest, there's meaning, there's everything you ever want.
Mm-hmm. What frustrates you about it?
I will say this. What frustrates most people about it is the complexity itself too.
Uh-huh.
The size, the cross-coordination that needs to happen. And so with that comes what could be perceived as slow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And comparing that to your experience in Creative Lab.
Oh, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
Creative Lab is moving fast.
Yeah. It's about ideas.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that's the thing. Like it depends on how you define yourself as a designer. Like, mm-hmm. like if you feel energized by creating visions, creating what is like desirable, then, you know, like a place like Creative Lab would be a great place for you. Mm-hmm. If you are motivated by what gets into the hands of users and actually have them use it and seeing how that impacts their lives, you're going to like be more attracted to work with product, mm-hmm. right?
We're getting to a close here. There's so much I want to talk to you about, and maybe we can do a little bit more offline. But I want to talk to you about what you're doing now at Google, what you think your trajectory is, and I want you to talk a little bit about the courses that you're teaching at Google.
Yeah, so I think there's two parallel trajectories, maybe not parallel, but two trajectories nonetheless.
Two possible.
Yeah, yeah.
Two roads diverge.
One is to continue to like improve search, make it not just better, but like ensure almost like the future of the company, mm-hmm. and see like, you know, what is search supposed to be like years from now? Like, mm-hmm. will it stay relevant or is there something else? Will it evolve or are we going to be defeated by innovators' dilemma? Mm-hmm. So that's like one trajectory. The other one is I've started to teach a course called Make Meditation Easy.
Okay.
And this is really... So there's been like this kind of rising of the topic of like mindfulness among various Silicon Valley companies. Time Magazine did, you know, like a number of like magazines and stuff. Mm-hmm. But so even within Google, like, you know, we're seeing all these classes about getting people to apply mindfulness to their work-life settings to do a number of things like improve stress, emotional intelligence-based leadership and things like that. And I see people like, oh, meditation's awesome. It's the silver bullet. It'll like cure everything from cancer to like anger management. mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then no one can do it.
It's the new quinoa. Yeah.
It's
that was good.
Except 50% of people don't stop eating quinoa after they try it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good point. So there's a huge drop-off rate with meditation.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And that is the problem that I'm trying to solve.
Yeah. Okay. Because it's a long road. It's a lifelong practice, right?
Yeah.
And the reason I'm mentioning that is that there's a mentor of mine at Atlassian, and she's a yogi, and she's been practicing mindfulness for 20 odd years.
Yeah.
And she talks about the principle of Shuhari, and and you can just tell how with it she is. But that didn't happen because she, you know, practiced it for 2 months.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that you're going at it for what was the course called? Meditation Made Easy, or
Meditation Easy.
Make meditation
because easy. It's hard.
Yeah. so it's interesting that you're taking that approach.
We're definitely going to jump into that more with the next episode next week, and kind of like dive into what your course material is actually like and sure. what learnings you've had through teaching it. But we're going to wrap this up. Daniel, I want to thank you for stopping by tonight. It's been so much fun. I you know, I've been telling Los for like how long?
Oh,
I'm like, there's this guy Daniel at work.
We had about a quarter's worth of episodes.
A quarter's worth. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I want to give you a big thank you for showing up tonight on your own time and sitting with us and discussing things. Lois, how do we end this show?
Oh, I think we play maracas. air maracas. It's like air guitar, but air maracas. No, you can find us on Late Nights with Trav and Lois on your favorite podcast player. You can find us on travandlois.com, on Instagram,
@TravinLos on Twitter, @TravinLos, and you can email us TravinLos@gmail.com.
All of that stuff. All of it.
You name it. We got it.
All right. Thanks again, Daniel. Good night, everybody.
Good night.